Football Weekly with James Richardson.
Football Weekly. Callum Harry Tottenham as Wizard Redknapp joins Spurs in a white heart transplant, dropping Pompey like one of his H's. Meanwhile, Chelsea's home record is water under the bridge as Liverpool beat the Blues at home. Next up for Chelsea, the kings of capital punishment, Hull City. We round up all the weekend's news and turn our thoughts with super tanker-esque agility to the big midweek round of Premier League matches. Also today, it's Bar Hamburg for Martin Jol as Hoffenheim win the battle of the top two in the Bundesliga. There's news from Spain of another big win for Barca, and Italy, where it's all going happily for Napoli. All that, plus top listeners' posts in another very exciting instalment of Football Weekly. Hear that, listeners? That's the wind of change, that is, and it's a blowing through this pod, ruffling the attractive coiffures of the assembled podcast. We have Barry Glendenning.
Hello.
Hi, Barry. I suitably nonplussed. Raphael Honigstein.
Hello.
I bet you appreciated the Scorpions reference there, didn't you, Raphael?
My favourite band.
Indeed. I think all of our favourite band. Fernando, you're still big on Dire Straits from back in the day, but hello to you.
Oh, Scorpions was a great band as well. Indeed.
Hello, no, they weren't.
Sean Ingle, the voice of dissent.
Well, they weren't a great band, and you haven't got any hair, so you're not coiffured.
That's true. Thanks for pointing that one out, Sean. Off to a happy start as ever.
Speaking of happy start. Yes. As opposed to happy finishes, obviously. Harry Tottenham. Could you not have called him Harry Kidnap? Because he's been abducted from France.
Hey, you know, that's quality. Yeah. Harry Kidnap. It's a tanter later on. Hey, dear supporter, how quickly things change in football. Daniel Levy's words, not mine, this week. And my word, that's certainly true, isn't it? Spurs through. Really threw us one out of left field there. How, on the surprise-o-meter, how would you rate this 1 to 10?
Well, I found out about this via text while I was strutting my stuff on the dance floor of Borderline nightclub in London, and I was very shocked.
Great.
Lost my rhythm briefly and nearly fell over. But yeah, it's a huge surprise. Whether or not it'll work, I don't know, because as soon as I heard it, after getting home, I checked Harry's stats the last time he was brought in to put out a fire at Southampton.
Mm.
His record was very, very poor. He was there for a year and he had a win percentage of less than 30%, I think about 24-25%, and he got the Saints relegated. But a lot of people think that was he did it on purpose just to further endear himself to Portsmouth fans.
Mm. Well, the comparison he's been making is when he first turned up at Portsmouth, where they were in a similar predicament to Spurs now, and they were able to survive. How fair do you think the comparisons are, Sean Ingle?
Possibly. I mean, he struggled a bit at Portsmouth, I think, didn't he, before?
They stayed up by the skin of their teeth, but stayed up.
I think he's a decent manager, but I think he's helped an awful lot by his friends in the media. Compare and contrast him with Glenn Roeder, who I think Glenn Roeder took over from him at Upton Park. Everyone hated Roeder because he was an hour late for press conferences. He didn't give any copy. There were only quotes worth copying. He was surly. Redknapp, for example, would always come in breezy, chatty, you know, always a story, always a good line. And I think that's helped Redknapp's career. I think he's a decent manager and the teams play decent football, but I think it does help that he gets a good press because he has good relationships with a lot of them.
Well, he's already had an immediate impact at White Hart Lane because his arrival has coincided. To what degree that's his merit with this first victory of the season?
I was chatting to people at Spurs today, and the quote was, you know, someone told me the mood is absolutely amazing. You know, in a few minutes he completely flew off the cobwebs, and you know, they're just
the cobwebs must have been happy, no? But anyway, and it also, I mean, apart from the kind of sea change in managerial styles. There's also a big change in the running of the club because they've now announced we've got rid of Camoli, there's not going to be a replacement, and he's going to do his old transfer things. We've decided it's time to go back to the old...
Slightly, I do think, and we've got this wrong, not myself, but other people in Football Weekly, and it's how Spurs do things. I mean, a lot of the media think it's just Camoli buying players right, left and centre.
Some people think it's Camoli.
Or Camoli even, apologies. But it's always been at Spurs that you have four people involved in the transfer, the chairman, sporting director, head coach and the club secretary. It's called the Football Management Group. The coach will turn around and say, I need a left back. And Spurs have got a network of scouts over 100 around around the world. God knows what they've been doing in the last few years. But anyway, and that a long list is drawn up, and then those four people sit down together.
Harry says that he's not going to have any. He'll
have to. I'll get into this.
Oh, okay.
The coach says I don't like him, so names are taken off. Club secretary will say, well, he'll never get a work permit, so others are taken off. The chairman will say, well, he costs too much money. But that, and then it's a collective decision. Now, Daniel Levy is a control freak, so I think, and you're going to need the club secretary to weigh in, and you're surely going to need a scouting network, because I think, you know, Redknapp, now how good he is, isn't going to be able to spot people from all
around
the
globe. How good is he? Because this is one of the great kind of truths of English football, is that Harry Redknapp is a master wheeler dealer. Is he? What do we all think?
For some people, definitely.
Yeah?
Not necessarily with football. But he's great at wheeling and dealing.
Right, but in terms of his football, in terms of his... No idea what you're talking about there, but in terms of signing players and picking up decent players without a massive outlay.
Well, I think if you sign like hundreds of players, and that's not an exaggeration, for example, at West Ham, I once looked it up, you're bound to find the occasional fantastic unknown player. Of course, all those no-names who then get sent back again after half a season are completely forgotten about. I think... He's probably a sort of a panic buy in terms of Daniel Levy, or panic signing, because he is someone brought in, I think, to keep the club up. I'm not sure strategically he's the one who's going to really move Tottenham to where they think should be, which is in the top four. I can't see him doing that. I don't think he's got enough know-how in actual footballing terms. I think he's a very good manager in the old British model of buying players and doing lots of deals, etc. But I don't think he can really bring a team onto the next level.
It's interesting, though, how Redknapp has been one of these managers that's consistently experimented over the years with different formations. He was 4-4-2 bad for a while. He's played 3-5-2 early this season. Last season was a lot of 4-5-1. So he does like experiment. How much of that is him and how much is your old mate Joe Jordan and Tony Adams? I don't know. But the point I was making earlier about the transfers, that under Ramos, the manager always had the ultimate approval, and that won't change under Redknapp. The only difference will be, I think, that you won't have a sporting director.
Does anyone else think it's slightly unfair? You're not allowed to buy players from other clubs when outside the transfer windows, but you can take a manager from another club. Myself and a mate were having a discussion yesterday, and we reckon that you should only be, if you sack your manager, we should only be allowed to take someone who's already out of work. And that, you know.
Very fair.
That's ridiculous.
No, it's very fair. Imagine
how is it more ridiculous than not being allowed to sign players?
Because you're signing, when it comes to players, the whole idea is that you protect the squads. But why shouldn't you get...
Because the idea of protecting managers from being signed is that you would equally protect the squad, because now Portsmouth have been left without their manager, kind of on 24 hours notice.
But they've got a £5 million payoff.
£5 million isn't much.
You're raising the issue of what happens with Portsmouth here, and it is a fine one. Not sure who's going to be joining them, but they've already taken him back once, Harry, and it's a bit of a rotten move from his point of view to walk out on them again, isn't it?
But that's Redknapp's always done that. That really is a dealer and. Disclaimer, not an actual dealer, a wheeler and dealer.
Are you suggesting Harry Redknapp sells crack to school children in his spare time?
No, listen, nobody in that club should be absolutely totally annoyed or totally unhappy with this guy. This guy won the FA Cup with them, and for heaven's sake, saved them from relegation like two seasons ago. So, you know, if they might feel hurt now, but then to actually demonize Harry Redknapp for actually moving to a bigger challenge, and believe me, I mean, I don't blame him for going to Spurs. Whoever saves Spurs this season will actually keep talking on a half-distance season will be hailed as this kind of like a mastermind or webmaster or something like this.
Rafa, you wouldn't...
I just wanted to say that I think £5 million for a manager must be a great deal on its own. I don't think that's ever been achieved.
Really?
But if Portsmouth take on a new manager, say it doesn't work out, by the time they pay up his contract and get rid of him, that's the £5 million gone. £5 million in football now is a trifling amount.
Indeed. Now, not a trifling amount was 86 games that Chelsea went unbeaten in the league at Stamford Bridge. That all came to an end. A historic afternoon, Sunday, at Stamford Bridge. Raphael Honigstein, you were there.
Yeah, it didn't feel like a historic afternoon somehow. It was a great game, very entertaining. Certainly the first half I thought was excellent. But it was all really, for me, about Liverpool playing really, really well. And the best I've seen them... Well, in a long, long time, I can't remember certainly seeing them play so well in the Premier League. Whenever they've come away from home, they used to be very negative and trying to almost play for a draw. But this time, they really went for it, certainly first half, and I think they got a well-deserved win. And I think for me, the focus should be on them rather than Chelsea losing. And I think Scolari, I believed his line, you know, afterwards he said, you know, to me, this record is nothing. It's 3 points that we lost. If we win the second leg, as he called it, the return match, then that's fine. And I'm sure he's the sort of guy who would say, you know, if we win there, we're in a better position than drawing twice against them and protecting that record. And I think he's got a point.
Liverpool are now beaten Chelsea and Man United without Fernando Torres.
It's astonishing. I mean, I keep expecting the squad they've got and with the injuries they've had not to have done so well. I think they've been a little lucky on a couple of occasions. I don't think they played that well throughout the season, but there are echoes of United 2002-03, I think, you know, where they started slowly but kept picking up the points. But I thought yesterday they were terrific and they utterly deserved their victory.
Man City last year were top around this point, were they not? They were up there. And look what happened to them. Could this be Liverpool's year, or are they going to just spectacularly
close? It could be, but only time will tell whether it is.
Thanks for that.
I'm not going to speculate because they could end up finishing fourth.
What's your feeling? What does your gut tell you?
My gut tells me that Chelsea will win the league, and my head tells me that Chelsea will win the league, but on the evidence of yesterday's performance, they may not. I think Chelsea deserve immense credit for stringing together an 86-match unbeaten run at home. I think it was Richard Williams or Kevin McCarra today, I can't remember which of them, sort of wagged their finger at Chelsea's fans who sort of left Stamford Bridge yesterday. Some left early, you know, didn't applaud their team. You know, that was a marvellous achievement to string together
another thing's worth mentioning, I think, is like that. Chelsea were without Essien, without Ballack, without Drogba, without Cole. I mean, I think the question with Liverpool we have to wait to answer is their squad. It's certainly thinner than United and Chelsea, possibly even Arsenal, although I'm sure Liverpool fans would disagree with me there. Can they go through the whole of the season and, you know, and be in the Champions League and be competing for the couple of cups and still be a contention come March and April? That's a question we don't know yet.
I've read several articles in recent days about how Big Phil made Chelsea lovable again. Who loves them that didn't love them like when Mourinho was in charge?
I'm happy to watch a Chelsea game in a way.
Everyone I know still can't stand them.
I think people like Mourinho, and that's first season of his where Red Robin got in. I think it was probably, you know, September, October, November, December time, and they were knocking 4 goals past pretty much everyone. I think they know in Europe as well. They thrashed Bayern, didn't they? They both 4 goals. They thrashed Barcelona that season, and they ran riot. And I think Barry's absolutely right. You either like Chelsea or you don't. I don't think Phil Scolari has changed that.
No, I don't think that's right. I think he's made them a lot more likable. Certainly in global terms. People in England who have their teams will not going to say, okay, oh, I love Scolari now, I'm going to go from Arsenal and move my allegiances to Chelsea. But from a neutral's perspective, this Chelsea with Scolari is much more likeable. And a guy who never blames the opposition, never blames the referee, never talks about conspiracies, all these things that these massive chips on Jose's shoulders are gone.
But they were quite entertaining.
Well,
for us,
for the first,
I mean, football is a soap opera.
For the first half of the season,
you need pantomime villains like Mourinho.
Also, this weekend, of course, other excitements such as Everton holding United to a draw, Man United, and Sunderland getting that historic win amid the rubbish bags over Newcastle, and another brilliant free kick from that man, Ken Richardson. We'll talk more about all that later on as we look forward to the midweek around, because that's probably enough for part one. Very, very shortly, we're going to dial up Sid Lone and get our European roundup underway. Now, on the line from, I'm guessing, Madrid is Sid Lowe. Sid, you're well?
Well, I'm not actually in Madrid, as you said. I'm in Villarreal at the moment. I was at the game last night where Villarreal and Atletico Madrid played out a quite brilliant 4-4 draw. Which was just, I mean, it was just ridiculous on so many different levels. You almost don't know where to start with it. But it's been a great weekend, and I think one of the reasons why that 4-4 draw is so pleasing is because it's been such a good weekend, and it's not the first time there's been a good weekend this season. And I think after 2 years where, in truth, I thought La Liga was pretty poor and pretty boring and lots of very poor teams, I think we're getting to the stage now where it looks like there's actually quite a lot of good teams around.
Sid, that's a big call, because, I mean, there's been loads and loads of goals in the last couple of seasons. Why there haven't been perhaps any great teams, there's been lots of good matches.
Yeah, but I think if you look at some of the matches in the last few seasons, I mean, there's been lots of good matches because they stand out, but there's also been a hell of a lot of really awful ones. I mean, over the last couple of years, I must say, I certainly felt like I've sat through a lot of pretty dull matches, whereas this year I feel like I've sat through a lot of very, very good ones, much more so than in previous years. Now, obviously, to some extent, there's a personal side of that. Maybe I've been lucky enough to have been at good ones this time and unlucky enough to have been at bad ones before. But I think if you listen to, certainly to Spanish commentators, they're all looking at it now and thinking, hey, we've got a genuine title race this year. We've got good teams playing reasonably good football. And that's something that in the last couple of years really hasn't been the case.
Sid, which of the two teams last night will see it as 2 points drop? Because they were both two goals up at one stage.
Yeah, I think Villarreal much more than Atletico Madrid. And Atletico Madrid were 2-0 up after 20 minutes. One of them was just a fantastic shot from Simao in the first minute. And then they got another one and they were 2-0 up. But Villarreal, even at that stage, had most of the ball. Then Atletico got Ever Banega sent off for being thick and diving into a challenge that he didn't need to dive into when he already had a yellow card. And Villarreal completely took control of the game. And I think one of the things that's striking is Villarreal scored 2 to make it 2-2, and then they got 2 more to make it 4-2, and they were so dominant at that stage. And I think both coaches thought that it was all over, and I think that one of the key symbols of that is the fact that Manuel Pellegrini took off both Robert Pires and Santi Cazorla, who were his best two midfielders creatively, apart from Marcos Senna, who was brilliant as usual. Took those two off basically to give them the rest. And now Pires is obviously pretty old and his knees are shot to pieces and he does need the rest. But they kind of collapsed after that and failed to keep the ball. But the other change that I think really shows that both coaches thought it was all over was that Sergio Agüero was warming up at 3-2 for Atletico Madrid. And it was like Aguirre was saying, all right, I'm going to throw on Agüero. I know he's not fit, but he's our best player. He's the only chance we've got. When it went 4-2, he told him to stop warming up and didn't bother sending him on because he decided it was all over. He himself admitted at the end of the game, we were dead, very dead. And then totally out of the blue, Simao scored one and then created another. And Aguirre himself admitted that while we scored 2 goals, we didn't really do a huge amount to score them.
Now, meanwhile, across town, Real Madrid got a battling 3-2 win over Athletic Bilbao. Sporting Gijón continued their amazing
run.
Sporting Gijón won 3-0 against, what was it, Deportivo. And Villa support group, meanwhile, asking about two, and I use his phrase, idiots on Goal TV, who were ranting on about Joan Laporta buying, starting or promoting an MLS club in Miami. Can Sid please elaborate on what the hell he's up to and why? Could you, Sid?
I can certainly try, yeah. Barcelona basically, yeah, are looking into buying a franchise for the MLS, so there will be a Barcelona American team for the MLS, which obviously, I mean, in a way sort of makes some sense in so much as if there's a franchise there and Barcelona see the US as an emerging market, then it's which of course they do, then it's kind of worthwhile. I don't think, for what it's worth, that this will mean anything like, for example, sending Henry to play there or anything like that. I think it will literally just be a Barcelona franchise with a Barcelona name, Barcelona colours. I don't think it will go any further than that.
All right. Now, Barcelona, we should give a quick mention to, because another massive goal fest for them. 5 goals scored in, what, about 32 minutes in their big, big win over, who were they playing? Almeria.
Almeria, yeah. Yeah, I turned the telly on a tiny bit late and it was 3-0. I went to put the kettle on and I came back and it was 4-0. So I'm probably not the man to tell you what happened in the Barcelona game. But from watching that and, of course, from watching the rest of it and watching the roundups, they were brilliant again. And they're now, Barcelona, running at 3 goals a match on average, which would, if they were to keep it up, now obviously they're not likely to, but it would make them the top-scoring team ever in La Liga history. And, of course, the Catalans now are falling over themselves to find a new name for Barcelona because, of course, they had the dream team and Guardiola was saying, well, yeah, but, you know, we'll never be like the dream team. So they're coming up with all sorts of ridiculous names about what they should be called now, like Pep's Boys and God knows what else. But they certainly look very, very good indeed. I think there's one other thing that probably needs pointing out at this stage, which is Barcelona are obviously patting themselves on the back and deserve to in a lot of ways. But the man who's on 9 goals this season and playing brilliantly is the man they tried to sell in the summer, which is Samuel Eto'o.
Sid, I'm just jumping ahead of Sean, who's seen my notes and wants to ask you this question himself.
Jimbo,
but
that's
it's my
coming
question.
From you.
It's my question. What's been the, finally, and as briefly as you can, what's been the Spanish reaction to Wandy Ramos's demise at White Hart Lane?
Well, the reaction in Seville, as you can probably imagine, while it's not public, is very definitely laughing up their sleeves. They're delighted with this. They see this as Judas getting what he deserves. But the reaction everywhere else...
Are they talking about Redknapp or Ramos there?
Ramos.
Right, OK.
The reaction in the rest of Spain is that Ramos has... has come a cropper at the hands of a club that's that hasn't done him any favours, that sold his best two strikers. There's a belief that the problem probably lies somewhere else. Although there's one thing that probably is worth pointing out here, which is that while Ramos is a manager that's quite admired in Spain for what he did and for what he achieved at Sevilla, he's not a manager that's very well liked. He's not very charismatic. He's not particularly chirpy with the media. In fact, he's unbelievably dull. And I think there's a feeling that while there's some sympathy for losing for him losing his post at Spurs, there isn't really any kind of sense of rallying to his cause.
No. Excellent. Cheers, Sid. Excellent roundup there. And we look forward to speaking to you on Thursday.
Yeah, quality. Speak to you then. Cheers.
Thanks, then. Well, our thanks to Sid Lowe for that. And Raphael Honigstein, hey?
Hello.
How about that Bundesliga? I see there were a couple of particularly interesting, if I may permit, a couple of very interesting results. Obviously, the Hoffenheim-Hamburg thing, but also...
The Hoff, number one in Germany.
Yes.
Who'd have thought?
Who indeed? You take us away, Raphael. Off you go.
Can it get any more stereotypical? The Scorpions, Hasselhoff,
yeah.
What's next? Nina.
Leather cakes.
99 red balloons. Right. Yeah.
Yep. 99 Silouf balloon.
Hey, all right then. But anyway, as you were saying...
Yes,
Raphael.
First of all, Bayern, 2-0 down after a few minutes... Klinsmann crisis, everything about to happen again. But then Ribéry scores just before half time. Klinsmann apparently has this fantastic team talk where he shouts at the players and he motivates them, and everybody shouts at each other, "We're going to do it," and da da da. He makes a couple of very astute tactical decisions. He puts Zé Roberto as the outstanding player for Bayern. He shouldn't be, he's 34 going on 50 in midfield. He puts him at his left back. Brings in Borowski, and all of a sudden they turn the game around and it's 4-2 in the end, and everybody's singing, the whole stadium celebrating, etc. And Bayern jumps seven places to fourth.
That's crazy.
Meanwhile, Hoffenheim win the top game, first against second, in a fashion that even though we've become accustomed to their fantastic football, again surprised everybody, because you know, you do it against middle teams, etc., but you do it against Hamburg, who were first.
Did they make mincemeat of them?
Did they murder them. Yes, I did get the joke. They did murder them. They ate them for breakfast. They completely overwhelmed them within a few minutes to God. Everything was so quick. Their football seems to be from another planet compared to where Hamburg were reacting to it, and they had no chance. And, you know, week in, week out, people are saying, you know, how far can these guys go? Can they keep it up, etc.? Now, despite all the protestations, I think they themselves will see themselves as genuine contenders for the Champions League. Perhaps not for number one, but definitely for the Champions League.
Sounds like they demolished Hamburg with relish.
I think it'll be hard for everyone else to catch up.
A quick observation about Zé Roberto. His original position was left back. He was very good. He used to play for the national team as well. Like every left Brazilian left back, when they go to Europe, they immediately are moved to midfield. I'm pretty sure that Klinsmann knew that, even though he's a bit old for a left back. How is he actually doing that? Because I followed Germany in the World Cup, and he seemed to be this guy who could actually fire up those guys. And actually, it inspired Brazil to bring Dunga as kind of like Klinsmann's next move.
Are Hamburg in a pickle?
There's a serious football conversation going on to the left of you. Well, myself and Jimbo have got the fit of the giggles here.
Well, Klinsmann's had a bad start because he's been experimenting a lot without great success, changing the teams, changing the tactics, changing a lot of the setup, training, etc. And he had to backtrack a little bit. Now the team that is playing and the formation they're playing is essentially Hitzfeld's teams from last season. And the sort of revolution and all the radical terminology has been put on the back burner a little bit. The problem is, at a club like Bayern, you always have to mix the visionary with the pragmatic, because you need to win regardless how. Every game is a must-win game. And it's very difficult to have sort of long-term ideas and visions when at the same time you have to churn out results.
There you go then. That's the Bundesliga. A whopper of a result anyway for Hoffenheim against... What? Against Hamburg. Magnificent. Now, Nisi the Red posted in with a song, which unfortunately now has completely been outdated by the fact that Harry Redknapp's joined. The day that Tottenham died, it was to the tune of American Pie sample lyrics, and My Kiss You for Goodbye, when Camoli sold the goalie, well, it made Levy cry.
You could do better than that, Jim, but we all heard you last week.
Well, no, I mean, unfortunately, events have overtaken that. Blade Runner 925 continuing the interesting debate about my education. You are the winner of a fiver. Blade Runner 925, or Fag Number One, as I think I probably knew you in my school days. And Private Dick, I'm sorry to hear about your issues with people who went through boarding school education. Many people, and Barry Glendinning, have been to similar establishments.
Yes.
And, yeah.
Football. Were you ever anyone's fag, Jimbo or Barry?
Fagging had a different connotation at my place of education. Yeah, we didn't have personal fags. That's something that used to happen a lot in times gone by, that older boys would have their pet would have their pick of the new intake, as it were, and that would be their fag, with all that that implies. But fagging had just become a bizarre thing where one of the prefects would stand in the corridor and shout, "Fag!" And then you would all have to run. If you were, I think, in the first 2 years of your education there, you'd all have to run. The last person to get there would do whatever unpleasant duty needed doing.
Did you ever play revolting games with a digestive biscuit?
No, I never had that.
Me neither, but everyone assumes if you went to you spent your entire time huddled in a circle of adolescent boys with a packet of McVitie's.
Wandering around with a broomstick and a tub of chocolate.
I can't understand why any parent would want to send their kids to boarding school.
Right, you've not had kids, have you?
He's about to.
I'm about to, yeah.
No, I
should be off to Cheltenham College for Young Ladies before you can say bye or leave.
Okay, let's move on. Part three, Italy. After this. Right now, big midweek round of games awaiting, both in the Premier League and abroad, in Italy too, where the situation is very finely poised. Five teams, Udinese, Inter, Napoli, Milan and Fiorentina, within 1 point of each other at the top of the table. Joining us now on the line from Milan, Paolo Menicucci. Paolo, how are you?
Hi, fine, thanks. And you?
Excellent. And enjoying this Campionato so far, I imagine?
Yeah, everything looks very balanced and tight at the top, so finally some excitement.
How many of those five do you think are realistic title candidates?
Honestly, two. I don't know if I'm too pessimistic, but I think that it will be a race between the two Milanese sides, Inter and Milan.
Now, Milan got a 1-0 win away to Atalanta. Inter, meanwhile, were held 0-0 at home by Genoa, sparking the ire of the newly shaven-headed Jose Mourinho, who's been banging on about how his players don't know who he is yet and they're all going to be dropped and stuff.
Exactly, like you say, that he will drop someone for the upcoming game against Fiorentina. The performance was not very good. I was at the stadium and some of their players look a bit tired. In my opinion, he should rotate them a bit more because, for example, Zlatan Ibrahimovic is playing every game and he was not fully fit when the season started. He had a problem with his knee and he's continuing to play every fair day. And I don't know, I think that they don't look so fresh right now, but they're still strong. I think they're still the best team in Italy.
Listen, aside from Inter, who remain up there and up near the top, you've got Napoli continuing their extraordinary season. They are now sharing the lead for the first time since 1991, not including the opening day of seasons since then. You don't think that they're going to be able to last the course, though, Paolo?
Actually, it's like they're not a big surprise for staying in top position. I don't think they have the strength to go until the end to win the Scudetto, but they can stay in contention for a place in the Champions League because they have a good team. They have a few young players. They have this Argentina forward, Lavezzi, who is continuing to play excellent football. They have Gargano and Amzic in midfield, who I think that they will be for top clubs next season if De Laurentiis, the owner of Napoli, will be eager to sell them, because it's like they are good financially. They can keep their main players.
They had a 1-0 win away to Lazio, the former league leaders, at the weekend. One of the things, I guess, compared to the old glory years under Fellaini, is that now they seem to be all about picking up younger players on the cheap who then turn out to be completely brilliant, like Lavezzi, like Hamzic, like Santa Croce as well. So yeah. I mean, how much of an impact is it going to have down south? Because I mean, southern Italian football has been just a desert for so long.
Yeah, exactly. But there was some teams coming back to Serie A, but never fighting for the title like Napoli right now. Like we had a couple of seasons where there were Regina, Messina, Lecce, four or five teams in Serie A, but always fighting for avoiding relegation. While now Napoli back at the top, there is a big injection of enthusiasm for, especially because Napoli is amazing with their fans. Like there were 60,000 when they were in 60,000 spectators when they were in Serie C or Serie B. So now it's the enthusiasm there is just amazing. Like,
well, there you go, Paolo. Next up for midweek, we've got Roma, Sam, Milan taking on Siena, Catania, Udinese, and Fiorentina hosting Inter, which is certainly going to be a very interesting game indeed. Many, many thanks for that little window on the world of Italian football, Paolo.
A pleasure.
Thank you very much indeed.
You're welcome. Bye bye.
Now, midweek in the Premier League, I believe that Barry and Sean have made a little bit of notes on stuff. Newcastle are playing on Tuesday against West Brom.
Do you want to see my notes?
Yeah, go on.
I've got blue arrows pointing at two fixtures.
Right.
And then I have a blue ring around Newcastle United with an arrow pointing to the word doomed.
Doomed, okay.
They're my notes.
Yeah, okay, doomed in the sense that despite the advent of Kinnear,
I think they're going to get relegated.
Really?
They got beaten by Sunderland. In Sunderland for the first time in 165 years
Kieran
on Saturday.
Richardson.
Brilliant free kick from Kieran Richardson, which was allowed this week. Clocked at 76 miles an hour or something. He had the wind behind him, but it was a bullet.
It was.
Adair had a free kick 110 miles an hour that was clocked in around the early 1980s. A brilliant Brazilian.
Adair relationship.
110 miles an hour?
Yeah. According to my shoot magazines from the early 80s. Which
110 miles an hour?
I mean, the technology perhaps wasn't as good then, but he was the fastest.
He was an animal. He was fantastic. He scores that goal against the Russians in the 1982 World Cup that Dasayev is rooted to the ground and looks at the ball bouncing around him.
Could it have been kilometres?
No, it says hours on my shoot
We didn't
magazine.
Have kilometres in those days.
I reckon that might have been a typo. But
11 miles an hour?
Yeah.
That's the one that crawled in.
But back to your notes.
Oh, yeah, my notes. Yeah. No, I just think Sunderland or Newcastle have been playing quite well under Joe Kinnear. They've got 2 points out of nine, and that's relegation for them by any standards.
Mm.
They're probably going to be bottom of the table by Wednesday, and I can't see things getting much better for them.
You don't think they're going to pick up 3 points against West Brom?
No.
Okay. Meanwhile, moving on to Wednesday, Arsenal, who are fresh from that 2-0 victory in their derby with West Ham, face another cross-London clash, this time with Spurs.
I imagine it'll be a very similar game. I mean, the West Ham yesterday, they sat very deep. They just tried to get in the nil. I'm sure Redknapp will go to the Emirates, with exactly the same philosophy. Deny Arsenal space, just try and hang on in there. Again, speaking to people from Spurs this morning, they haven't got much hope. Well, they are quite confident about getting something against Liverpool on Saturday, but I think Arsenal will probably end up winning that.
Why are they more confident against Liverpool than they are?
A home game, and people are asking how good Liverpool are.
It's a difficult time for Harry to turn up, though, isn't it? Because there's absolutely no time to try and affect any changes or even take stock of the situation.
But
it's just game after game.
The point is that I used to make about the England team when everyone was slating them off. They weren't that bad. They're not brilliant. And I think the same applies to Spurs. They're not the greatest team in the world, obviously, but look at the players they've got. They should be good enough to finish at the top half of the table.
Yeah, like West Ham was a couple of years ago and they should went down.
Hmm. Well, interesting. Interesting. Liverpool, your team, Fernando, taking on Portsmouth.
They should win it, but again, it's always Liverpool. They drop points at Stoke, against Stoke at home, for example. So you never know. But they're supposed to win those games if they want to win the championship.
Absolutely.
Sorry, could I just preempt some allegations of bias from our listeners who post on the blog? Some Sunderland fans let themselves down quite badly on Saturday. There was a pitch invasion, which was something or nothing. But when Joey Barton was warming up for Newcastle, he had missiles thrown at him. He was spat at. And one fan even made a go for him.
Didn't you say they let themselves down?
Yeah, they did let themselves down.
Oh, sorry.
They're no better than... Well, I mean, I'm the only person in the world I know who has sort of argued Barton's case for him in that the time he attacked that guy outside McDonald's, he was under extreme provocation. But he doesn't want sympathy or anything. But, those fans who are spitting at him, right. they're worse than he is.
Yeah.
Who gives a fan the right to be like absolutely barracking players just because he paid for the bloody tickets? It's like being in Circus Maximus, the Lions and the Gladiators, something like this.
You should see the things they post on our message board, and they don't even pay. They don't even pay, Fernando. Anyway, listen, moving on. Hull against Chelsea. Can the Tigers do it again?
Who's going to say they can't?
Who's going to say they can't? Go on. Nobody's going to say they can't.
I would still take. I would still take Chelsea to win that game.
Yeah, okay.
Especially after that result, I think one of Scolari's plus points seems to be that he's got a great grip on the group of players, and I think he'll use that defeat very much to their advantage. And perhaps, you know, coming off a win against Liverpool, this would be the sort of game where you say, "Oh yeah, away to Hull, we go for the motions. We've got to get a win anyway somehow," which the big teams invariably do, not against Hull but other teams. But I think they'll have a lot more motivation, a lot more focus. I think it'll be difficult.
Be interested to see whether how he shuffles his forward line, who Rob Smythe yesterday called various shades of pathetic, and you know, because I think that's the area they need to work at. And you wonder who there is.
You've got Bolton, Everton, you've got Fulham, Wigan, Aston Villa against Blackburn, Borough taking on Man City, Stoke, Sunderland, Man United host. Oh, go on then, Raphael.
No, it's just shouldn't we talk a little about Arsenal?
Oh, and then so talk about Arsenal.
No, I just think it's been an interesting week for them. The whole Cuppy.
Oh yeah.
Cuppy drama, right. Cuppy smoking gate or whatever it's called.
Yes, yes, a drama. Gate. Grown man smokes cigarettes on night out.
Surely you should
call the police.
William Galois rather than William Galois.
Well, the cigarette wasn't even on. But I think it's interesting. I still think it's interesting because obviously there's a lot of Arsenal fans who are really unhappy with Galois and were unhappy before because of the whole. But I think even Arsenal fans want their captain to be the good sort of British bulldog type, and he's clearly not. Mm. And I think the fact that there's been a bit of a hoo-ha about this whole smoking, in a way, I think helped Arsenal and helped Wenger a little bit.
Do you think he sent him out there to be a bit more tough, you know, with a cigarette and that?
I don't know. But he certainly, by all accounts, I didn't see the game, had a good game away to West Ham. And you know, maybe you need sometimes that little bit of friction.
Yeah.
Anyway, well, was Tony Adams a model of abstinence? I mean, just like I'm asking about captains being examples. Yeah.
Niall Quinn, Paul Merson.
Yeah, indeed. I just wanted to mention, finally, then, Manchester United against West Ham. Yeah, presumably, they'll be confident of their chances in that game. But it was curious how they fell apart after half-time away to Everton. They completely ran the game in the first half and second half couldn't do anything.
Absolutely. I was watching the game on Justin TV, which allows you to watch pretty much every game in the world, and I was probably getting the feed 30 seconds behind the Goodison Park spectators and slightly blurry pictures. But yeah, the first half they were very comfortable. Second half they could have perhaps even lost.
So could I just tell you about quickly my favourite football story of the weekend? Yes. I heard this just in passing on 6:06 on 5 Live. Some player in the FA Cup fourth qualifying round, I think it might have been a Torquay United player, got booked for, when he wheeled away to celebrate, he put on a Pirates hat.
And he got booked for that?
Got booked, yeah.
Do you know...
Because, you see, if he hadn't got booked next week, he'd be putting on a ruffled shirt and breeches and boots and a parrot on his shoulder. And then all hell would break loose.
Right.
So this kind of thing must be stamped out of the game of football.
Indeed. If you're interested in that story, I believe that Satanta's top football debate show, Football Matters, has a piece filmed at said FA Cup game with Torquay, which will be running tonight on Satanta.
It may not have been Torquay, but I have a feeling it was.
Right. Our feature may not be on Torquay either, I'm not sure. But we're on the air tonight, anyway. So
would you give my best to the delightfully fragrant Rebecca Lowe?
Oh, that's the first thing I'll be doing.
She doesn't even know who you are, Barry.
I know. She will.
Woo. And anyway, well, there you go.
I spend long enough parked outside her house watching.
The sad thing is that's true.
And anyway, so
Barry by name, Barry by nature.
I did notice, and this is slightly creepy, that she has a big red ruby rock on her engagement ring finger.
Really?
Yeah.
Anyway, right.
We better sign off from this
that's enough
episode
Football
of Zoo Weekly.
Forever. And we'll be speaking to you on Thursday, and in very high voices, in some people's cases, I suspect. But anyway, that's all for now. Many, many thanks, Fernando, Sean, Rafa, Barry, and producer Pete, and you, the listener. See you soon.